S5E8 of Fanacek. This is Keeping House Part 3, the finale of the Keeping House series. So, a little quick little recap in case you didn't remember, but I thought I would talk about some popular 80s sitcoms kind of through the lens of The Housekeepers and using that as kind of a gateway to explore the shows a little bit. First episode, we talked about Different Strokes, Give Me a Break, Mr. Belvedere. Second episode, Who's the Boss, and Charles in Charge, and which really gave me a platform to goof on Scott Baio because he's kind of disgusting. This is a little bit different. We're shifting gears for this finale. We're going to talk about two shows that didn't have housekeepers that should have had housekeepers because these are big homes with lots of people living in them, always pristinely clean, and seemingly no one cleaning them. So that made no sense to me. And we're also going to maybe dive a little bit deeper on each of these shows because they're both very iconic. Of course, they are The Golden Girls and The Cosby Show. And I have a lot to say about both of these shows. So without further ado, let's just dive right in. Over the years, right, I've told like anyone willing to listen that I would have made an excellent television executive. I can like take one look at a show's premise or cast or even its set and determine whether or not it'll be a hit, right? I'm very proud of this. To no one's surprise, most shows reek of failure, right? It never ceases to amaze me, like the amount of time and energy networks will spend creating and marketing a program that is like clearly, obviously a heaping pile of shit. Now, conversely, it seems obvious to me as well when they've created something that will have a long-lasting positive effect. My batting average is pretty high, and I'm sticking to my guns when I say I would have made one hell of an executive. However, there are two examples in television history where my predictions were way off and I would have humiliated myself had I been the man tasked with making the decision, okay? The first involves late night talk shows. I'm not a fan of late night talk shows like Carson, Letterman, Conan, Fallon. It's just not my thing. Mainly because I'm not a fan of staying up past 9:30, mind you. So that's kind of where I'm at. Despite my ambivalence though towards these shows, it's not lost on me that millions of viewers enjoy them, right? I'm clearly the odd man out, and I admit that. For years, I would lecture people on how a primetime talk show would be a ratings bonanza. And I'd give the following speech. So here's an example. The Tonight Show gets millions of viewers, loyal viewers, but I feel like they're missing out on the people who go to bed earlier. Imagine how big it would be if they had a primetime version of The Tonight Show, a late night show for a non-late night crowd. I was very proud of that. I believed in this with all my heart and soul. And then NBC did it in 2009, right, with the Jay Leno show. It was basically Jay Leno doing his Tonight Show thing, for the most part, weeknights at 10 o'clock. It was an epic failure and lasted only 10 months. I have since stopped giving my little speech about late night shows. The other thing I would have been completely wrong is the Golden Girls. If I had been an NBC executive in 1984 and Susan Harris came to me to discuss her idea for the Golden Girls, I would have had her escorted off the lot. I'm not even kidding. Don't pass go. Don't collect $200. Just get the fuck out. And I would have been wrong. I would have been fired. I would have been drummed out of the business. I would be a cautionary tale. Luckily for everyone involved, I'm just a snarky podcaster, so no harm, no foul. Let's discuss the Golden Girls, okay? Premiering on September 14th, 1985, as part of NBC's Saturday Night lineup, the Golden Girls was the story of four women in their golden years living together in Miami. It ran 177 episodes over seven seasons until its final episode on May 9th, 1992. The Golden Girls, along with 227, The Cosby Show, and Night Court, was a big part of NBC's ratings renaissance under Brandon Tartikoff. And its interest, its origin is actually kind of an interesting story. During the upfronts of the 1984 NBC lineup, two NBC actresses, Selma Diamond and Doris Roberts. Doris Roberts, of course, very famous. At the time, was on Remington Steele. Then she became Ray Romano's mom in Everybody Loves Raymond. But anyway, so during the upfronts, by the way, if you don't know what an upfront is, every year each network has what they call upfronts, where they take the fall lineup, all the shows that are coming out later in the year, whether they're returning shows, new shows, and they give examples of them to all these advertisers. And based on the strength of this demonstration, the advertisers decide if they're going to advertise, how much you're going to spend and all that kind of stuff. And it's gotten to be like a really big deal. Now they have like Jimmy Kimmel hosts, you know, the ABC ones. I'm sure Fallon is in his big mouth or involved in the NBC ones, but it's kind of a big deal every year, the upfronts, to get all the celebrities out there trying to drum up money from the advertiser. So sorry. So if you didn't know what upfronts were, now you do. So anyway, during the upfronts for the 1984-85 NBC lineup, these two actresses, Selma Diamond and Doris Roberts, performed a comedy skit to promote Miami Vice. The skit was called Miami Nice, and it was a parody about old people living in Miami. Right? NBC vice president at the time, Warren Littlefield, was in the audience and found the concept really interesting. So he commissioned producers Paul Junger-Witt and Tony Thomas to create a show around Miami Nice. They declined. No interest. But Witt's wife, Susan Harris, was intrigued enough to write a pilot for that demographic. That pilot was the Golden Girls, and the rest is history. Or herstory, if you will. Nailed it. This show crushed in both the ratings and the award shows. Over its run, it was nominated for 68 Emmys. It won 11. At the time of this podcast recording, it is only one of four shows where every principal actor took home an Emmy, the others being All in the Family, Will and Grace, and Schitt's Creek recently. How about that? They were so beloved worldwide that the Queen of England flew the ladies to London and had them perform for the royal family as their Golden Girls characters. My own mother, like the Queen of England, also loved this show. I'll never forget, 1988, she was going through her umpteenth breakup, and we had to drive from our current home in rural Louisiana to live with my grandmother in the Bronx, like you do. The car was tiny and cramped, full of our belongings. I specifically remember her pushing through exhaustion and hunger to make sure she was home in time to watch the new episode of The Golden Girls on Saturday night. That's how important this fucking show was to people. Now, if you are unaware of the Golden Girls cast, you should probably shut the podcast down and just walk out into traffic. You're listening to the wrong podcast. But I'm going to go ahead and give each of them a shout out anyway, for those of you who may not know. Rue McClanahan as Southern Belle Blanche Devereaux. Blanche, a widow, she owned the Miami house in which they lived. Blanche's hobbies include men, sex, self-absorption, promiscuity, and then men again, more men. Interestingly, this role was originally offered to Betty White, but feeling it too similar to her equally horny character, Sue Ann Nivens, from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, she ended up swapping roles with Rue McClanahan, because she basically played that kind of character on Mary Tyler Moore. Betty White played dim-witted Rose Nyland. Rose is also a widow, hails from St. Olaf, Minnesota, and loves to tell nonsensical stories from her hometown. Bea Arthur played no-nonsense Dorothy's Bornak. Dorothy was not a widow, but likely wish she was. Her loser ex-husband, Stan, left her for a younger woman and then didn't even have the sense to go away. Nope, this guy lingered around like a virus. He appeared in like a fucking third of the episode. So this guy leaves her for a younger woman and still sticks around. And then finally, Estelle Getty as Dorothy's Italian mother, Sophia Petrillo. Estelle was actually the second youngest cast member and had to endure 3 hours of makeup to achieve the look of much older Sophia. That's a lot. That's a lot to ask of an actor. 3 hours. Oof. Anyway, did the show have fabulous guest stars? You bet, man. You bet. Burt Reynolds, Robert Culp, my favorite, one of my favorites. I've done several episodes on Robert Culp. Leslie Nielsen, George Clooney, Dick Van Dyke, Mickey Rooney, Bob Hope, Debbie Reynolds, tons more. It even featured an unknown Quentin Tarantino as an Elvis impersonator. That's a fact, and it's going to come up later in the podcast. But Quentin Tarantino, at the time, a young struggling actor, appeared on the Golden Girls as an Elvis impersonator. And you can Google it and see it, but I'll discuss it here in a little bit. How about an awesome theme song? Did this show have an awesome theme song? Are you kidding? Thank You for Being a Friend might be the most covered television theme song of all time. It's not the catchiest or the flashiest, but then again, neither is the show. But I'll be damned if this theme song doesn't have some serious, serious staying power. Originally written and recorded by Andrew Gold, it reached number 25 on the US Billboard Hot 100 in 1978. A cover version was sung by Cynthia Fee, and that's what was used for the show. But other artists that have covered this little ditty include Dionne Warwick, Bernadette Peters, and Ringo Starr. Ringo fucking Starr. A Beatle covered the Golden Girls theme song. That's not too shabby. That's actually pretty cool. So our show isn't truly a hit, though, unless it has a spinoff, especially in the 80s. Well, guess what? Not only did the Golden Girls have a spinoff, its spinoff had a spinoff. Ooh, right? How very Norman Lear of them. If you don't get that, go back and listen to my Norman Lear episodes. The initial spinoff was Empty Nest, starring Richard Mulligan as the Golden Girls' neighbor. He was a widowed doctor whose adult daughters had moved back in with him. Empty Nest was a bona fide hit, man. It lasted 170 episodes over seven seasons from 1988 to 1995. Richard Mulligan's character, Dr. Harry Weston, was a pediatrician in a Miami hospital. There were many nurses working on the same floor as Dr. Weston, and I can prove it because NBC created an entire show centered around these nurses called Nurses. Very original title. They lose points for creativity, of course, but they also gain a few points because the show was also a hit. Kind of. It lasted 68 episodes over three seasons from 91 to 94. And that concludes the legacy of the Golden Girls. At least I wish it was, right? Sadly, the Golden Girls did try their hand at a continuation series. So I wish we were done with this part of it. This is only a big failure for the Golden Girls, really. So they tried again for a continuation series, which is also a very Norman Lear-ish thing to do. Think of like Archie Bunker's Place, right? You had All in the Family, then Archie Bunker's Place, which was a continuation. This one was called The Golden Palace, and it followed the lives of Blanche, Rose, and Sophia as they opened a hotel called, you guessed it, The Golden Palace. And this has happened after Dorothy Zbornak, Bea Arthur's character, got married and left town. It didn't last long, only 24 basically mediocre episodes, but it did give us Don Cheadle, and for that, I will forever be grateful. Okay, let's talk Housekeepers. I know what many of you are thinking, right? Especially if you're a Golden Girls nerd and you're one of those people who fucking email me all the time pointing out things I got wrong. Thanks, by the way. Much appreciated. But I know what you're thinking. The pilot episode featured a gay character, Coco, who was their cook slash butler slash manservant. I don't know. He was promptly written off the show. NBC didn't come right out and say it, but they didn't think America was quite ready for a gay butler every week. So that's why he was written off. There was also a later episode centered around the ladies hiring a housekeeper, but it doesn't work out. But for the most part, there's no evidence really of how big this big old house stayed clean, right? That's only two mentions of a housekeeper. Now, I take umbrage with this. First, can you imagine the smell in this house? I'm not trying to be crass, but I mean, I remember my grandma's smell. I'm not talking body odor, right? I mean the smell of old school makeup and hair product and eau de toilette, right? I mean, I'm telling you, the Golden Girls' house must have smelled to high heaven. I mean, these ladies were always done to the nines, which means lots of makeup, hairspray, parfumery, right? Multiply that by four, and you have quite the headache-inducing odor kind of wafting through that house. Think like Yankee Candle store kind of smell, right? And what about cooking smells? These ladies spent a lot of time in the kitchen cooking a lot of meals. That's a lot of odors, a lot of grease, a lot of dirty pots and pans and dishes. Speaking of dirty, where's the dirty laundry, right? Each lady goes through about four costume changes per episode, yet I never see anyone hauling a laundry basket across the house. I can do this all day, but here's the point. There is no way these ladies could have looked this good, eaten this well, and lounged so luxuriously in such a clean house without full-time help. I spent years living by myself in a tiny apartment and still had to knock out a few loads of laundry every week, right? Now that I have a family of four, and laundry is basically my fucking second job. That's my weekends. What are you doing this weekend, Fanacek? I'm doing fucking laundry. And towels and the linens and the girls and mine. And Jesus, I mean, so I call bullshit on these clean living ladies without a housekeeper. So let's ask the questions. Did it make sense that the Golden Girls did not have a full-time live-in housekeeper? No. Their dating lives and witty remarks would have devolved into lying in a pile of dirty drawers crying, "I've fallen and I can't get up." Did the housekeeper take too many liberties? N.A., man. Was he a surrogate parent? N.A. Did he do a good job? N.A. What's the final grade? Incomplete. Just like my report card oftentimes in high school. Incomplete. So that is their grade. I call bullshit. Now, this is normally, if you've been listening to the Keeping House series, this is normally where I would discuss and goof on some of the crazier episodes throughout the run of this show. And believe me, there's a lot of material to cover. Over its 7-season run, this show tackled tons of issues, right? Homosexuality, infidelity, homelessness, poverty, immigration policy, discrimination, anti-Semitism, nuclear war, the list goes on and on. However, upon further investigation of the Golden Girls' 177 episodes, I discovered an interesting trend that I felt compelled to explore and share. Now, keep in mind, I went through all 177 episodes of this show. I do it for you. I do it because I love you. I'm surprised I haven't gotten divorced over this nonsense. Okay. But anyway, so going through these shows, I've come up with this trend that I feel compelled to show you. And here it is. These ladies were all about dating and fucking, like nonstop. By my math, 70 episodes involved dating and or fucking in some capacity. That's 39.5%. Imagine how much dating and fucking they could have done if they had full-time help around the house. It would have been like 80%. It would have been wake up and fuck. That's it. Now, the possibilities are endless, right? But here is an episode by episode list involving all this dating and fucking that I've been talking about. So I'm going to discuss all 70 episodes that involve dating, screwing, in some capacity. So here we go. You ready? Buckle in, because this is going to get a little interesting. We're going to start with the pilot. They right off the bat, right? So S1E1, the engagement. This is the pilot episode, and Blanche is already accepting a marriage proposal. A sign of things to come for this show. S1E3, Rose the Prude. Rose is afraid to have sex with her boyfriend because it feels like she's cheating on her dead husband. Spoiler alert, she gets over it again and again and again, sometimes standing up. That made me laugh. S1E5, the triangle. Dorothy's boyfriend hits on Blanche. That makes sense. I mean, the part about Blanche getting hit on, not the part about Dorothy having a boyfriend. S1E9, Blanche and the younger man. Blanche dates an aerobic instructor who is considerably younger than her. I get that Blanche is the hot one, right? But I've been to Miami. Something must be really wrong with this guy if he's that into Blanche. I don't know. Again, I've been to Miami. You should check it out. S1E13, a little romance. Rose is afraid to tell her friends that she's dating a little person. I guess it's not cheating on your dead husband if it's with a midget, right? Isn't there a thing like, it's not cheating if it's a midget? No? Did I make that up? It's a great title, by the way. A Little Romance. I like that. S1E14. That was no lady. The ladies disapprove of Dorothy's affair with a married man. They all agree he can do better. Zinger. Okay. What do you want? It's free comedy. S1E15. In a Bed of Roses. Another clever title. Rose's boyfriend dies while having sex with her. Don't worry, it's not the midget. She dumped him, right? It turns out that her late husband died the same way. Damn. Rose must be bringing the heat, killing men in bed. I'm all in on that. S1E19, second motherhood. A wealthy widower proposes to Blanche. It's her second proposal of the season. Talk about suspension of disbelief, huh? Season 1, starting getting 2 marriage proposals. S1E20, adult education. An adult education teacher offers Blanche a passing grade in exchange for some lovin'. Mm-hmm. Remember Van Halen's Hot for Teacher? This is Hot Flash for Teacher. Sadly, that took me a while to think of that joke. Hot Flash for Teacher. All right. I don't know. That's I think it's pretty good. Okay. S2E1. End of the curse. Blanche thinks she's pregnant. Let's let that sink in for a moment. Blanche, a golden girl, thinks she's pregnant. Now, was the adult education class she took earlier in season 1, was that a sex education class? Was she not grasping the material? Is that why the teacher had to make her an offer to get a passing grade? I don't think you're pregnant, Blanche. I don't think it's happening. Anyway, S2E2, ladies of the evening. On their way to meet Burt Reynolds, Dorothy, Rose, and Blanche are arrested when they are mistaken for prostitutes. Okay, let's pause again. Have we already jumped the shark? We're two episodes into season two, and we've already dealt with a pregnancy scare and possible prostitution. What is going on with the Golden Girls? What's going on here? This is nutty. I don't remember it being this nutty. S2, E3, take him, he's mine. As a favor to Dorothy, Blanche goes on a date with Stan, only to get upset when they end up hitting it off. Is she really surprised? Has anyone ever had a bad date with Blanche? Right? It usually ends with a Hummer or something, right? A handy on the way to the motel room, a Hummer in the motel room. Everyone likes Blanche. S2, E5, isn't it romantic? Dorothy's lesbian friend has a crush on Rose. I don't have a joke for that one. I just kind of dig it. Dorothy's lesbian friend has a crush on Rose. There's actually, I didn't bother to write it down. There's actually a funny line in this episode. They're trying to explain to Blanche that the woman's a lesbian. And Blanche isn't grasping it. It's almost as if like being gay is so far out of her realm of understanding, right? And she's like, lesbian. She's like, well, isn't Danny Thomas one? And Blanche's like, that's Lebanese, Blanche. That made me laugh. She confused Lebanese with lesbian. Those are the kind of things that make old Fanachek laugh. S2, E6, Big Daddy's Little Lady. Blanche's father reveals he is getting married. Apparently, getting engaged on a regular basis runs in the family with Blanche. S2, E7, Family Affair. Rose's daughter has an affair with Dorothy's son. At this point, I'm starting to think this house is a natural aphrodisiac. All who enter are stricken with uncontrollable horniness. We're about 3 minutes away from an Eyes Wide Shut party here. You got the kids are banging, the old people are banging. Tom Cruise is going to walk in with a fucking mask on. S2, E10, Love, Rose. Jealous of all the dates Dorothy and Blanche are getting, Rose places a personal ad. This episode was significant as it is the only time anyone is ever jealous of Dorothy about anything. S2, E14, The Actor. A famous actor is in town for a local play. Of course, he is smitten with the Golden Girls and tries to carry on a secret affair with each of them. This synopsis would make a lot more sense if it started with, in a post-apocalyptic Miami. Right? That's a good joke. You have to give me credit on that one. S2, E18, Forgive Me, Father. Dorothy is attracted to a fellow teacher that turns out to be a priest. Great excuse, man. I've never used that one before. You're great, but my heart belongs to God. That's way to let her down gently. I dig that. I'm going to borrow that one. S2, E19, Long Day's Journey into Marinara. Sophia believes her sister... Sophia's like in her 80s, by the way. Sophia believes her sister is trying to steal her boyfriend. I'm sorry. Sophia believes her sister is trying to steal her boyfriend. I get it. At 81, her sister is younger and hotter. Oh, I'm having a good old time. Okay. S2, E22, Diamond in the Rough. Blanche is bothered by her boyfriend's lack of polish and social graces. To be fair, she's used to the first date ending in a marriage proposal and later a pregnancy scare. So this guy was a little outside the box for her. S3, E7, Strange Bedfellows. The ladies are supporting a local politician running for city council. To gain some notoriety, he claims to have slept with Blanche. Why lie? Wouldn't it be easier to take her on an actual date? Maybe bring some wine and roses? I was just kidding about the wine and roses. You don't need those. S3, E8, Brotherly Love. Dorothy goes on a date with her former brother-in-law. That sounds par for the course. I'm guessing a lot of family members have been asked, to task with taking her out on dates. Homecoming, prom, most Saturday nights. I think old Dorothy dated a lot of family members growing up. You know, he's not just my date, he's my dad. I thought my mom maybe went to the prom with her dad, but no, I think I confused that story. Okay, S3, E9, A Visit from Little Sven. Rose's cousin Sven is engaged to be married. Rose is busy, so Blanche takes him out to dinner and, of course, lacking all fucking boundaries, kisses him to make another man jealous. Sven, who shares the same retarded DNA as Rose, now believes he's in love with Blanche. Sven snaps out of it when he later learns that Miami is swarming with women under the age of 60. Because it's got lots of women under the age of 60, you see. It's Miami. S3, E12, Charlie's Buddy. Buddy Hawk, an alleged old wartime buddy of Rose's deceased husband Charlie, shows up at the house to pay his respects to Rose. Although having never met her before, he claims to have fallen in love with her through the letters that she would send to Charlie. They share one meal together before he asks her to move to Boston with him. She considers it. He then asks her to give him all her money before they leave. Again, she considers it. Eventually, he is revealed to be a phony and all ends well, but we're left with two lessons learned. One, maybe we don't accept proposals, invitations to move in, etc. after just one date. This means you too, Blanche. Everyone listen up. Maybe we don't do that. Two, it's time to consider putting these ladies in a home. Rose came shockingly close to giving all her money to and moving in with a con man. Let's get the adult children involved here, right? This is like, it seems like elder abuse. S3, E13, the artist. Blanche, Rose, and Dorothy compete for the attention of the same artist. I'm guessing his specialty is abstract art. You see, he's an abstract artist. That's flat. S3, E20, and Ma makes three. Dorothy is excited about her new boyfriend, but Sophia is being an annoying third wheel. I guess you just have to wait her out, Dorothy. It shouldn't be too long. A couple weeks, right? She's well into her 80s. S3, E21, larceny and old lace. Sophia is dating a retired gangster played by Mickey Rooney. She suspects that he robbed a bank just to impress her. It worked on Judy Garland. It's going to work on Sophia. S3, E22, Rose's big adventure. Rose's new boyfriend is recently retired and slowly turning into a couch potato. Rose tries motivating him to get off his ass and proves to be effective because he buys a yacht and offers to sail around the world with her. Conflicted and not wanting to say no to him nor leave her friends, she opts just to fuck him to death instead, as she's prone to do. Problem solved. Rose, get in there. Fuck that guy to death. So let's take a break. As we move into season 4 of The Golden Girls, let's pause and reflect on what the ladies have been up to throughout the first 3 seasons. Let's count the number of boyfriends, dates, and or sexual partners. If you're listening at home and want to track this, feel free to write this information down. So again, number of boyfriends, dates, and or sexual partners. Blanche, through the first 3 seasons, is up to 8. Dorothy is at 5. Rose is at 7, and 83-year-old Sophia is at 2. Get yours, Sophia. Now, the number of marriage proposals so far, Blanche has 2. The others have none. So well done, ladies. Let's see how the next few seasons go. So as we move into season 4, S4, E1. Yes, we have no Havanas. Blanche and Sophia are caught in a love triangle with an elderly Cuban cigar mogul. That's right, Blanche and Sophia. This guy clearly doesn't have a type, right? You got Blanche on one end of the spectrum and Sophia, who's like nearing death, okay? Anyway, interesting love triangle. S4, E3, the one that got away. Blanche spends time with the only man that ever turned her down, Ham Lushbaugh. That's his name, Ham Lushbaugh. Although considerably heavier than he used to be and not very attractive, Blanche still tries to seduce him so she can remove the only blemish on her otherwise perfect sexual stat sheet. I'm trying to think of a joke here. How about her breath smelled like ham in the morning? Huh? Her breath smelled like ham in the morning? Or she invited Rose to join them and they made a ham sandwich. Eh? I'll put it on the plate. You eat if you're hungry. I don't know. I like those two. I couldn't tell which was the better joke. S4, we got a two-parter. S4, E6, and E7. Sophia's Wedding, parts 1 and 2. Sophia's wedding, mind you. Sophia's friend dies, which happens to her twice a week. Sophia's friend dies. I'm having too much fun doing this. I'm a fucking loser. Okay. While at the funeral, she hooks up with the widowed husband and marries him. Boom. That's how you snag a man, bitches. It's like getting an apartment. You know, you wait till someone dies, you go over and get their apartment. The wedding features a bunch of Elvis impersonators. Look closely and you'll see that one of them is Quentin Tarantino, right? And this is a true story. Some of the money that he earned from this appearance helped fund Reservoir Dogs. So Sophia, you know, her friend dies. She marries the widowed husband. Quentin Tarantino makes Reservoir Dogs because of it. It's all connected, folks. S4, E9, scared straight. Blanche's brother is afraid to admit he's gay, so he lies and says he slept with Rose. The others know he's lying because history has taught us that sex with Rose is lethal. You couldn't have fucked Rose, you'd be dead, sir. Columbo can't even figure that out. S4, E12, blind date. Blanche makes a date with a man that she doesn't realize is blind. I think the lesson was supposed to be that he's able to like her for who she is on the inside because he obviously can't see her good looks. The lesson I took from it, though, is that even a blind man can spot a whore. right? A blind man could tell she was a whore. Eh, that's funny. S4E13. The impotence of being earnest. Rose is dating a man that turns out to be impotent. Rose is dating a man that turns out to be impotent. I don't know if it's like a cause and effect thing. It's like, I'm dating an old bitch. It doesn't work anymore. Anyway, I'll start over. Rose is dating a man that turns out to be impotent. They go away for a weekend, and Rose helps him solve his problem. Feeling great about himself again, he leaves her to patch things up with his estranged wife. Yikes, that stings. Like, what is the lesson here exactly? Like, I want to cheat on my wife, but I feel embarrassed because I'm impotent. My mistress is going to help me get over this impotence. Ooh, all fixed up. Fuck you, mistress, going back to the wife. That's awful, awful, awful. S4E14, love me tender. Dorothy dates a short, bald man that she has nothing in common with except for great sexual chemistry. This dude is not much in the looks department, but boy, can he screw. And the problem is, what's the problem here? He's all you need. Dorothy, you know, beggars can't be choosers. S4E22, Sophia's choice. Blanche gets a bonus at work and decides to get her breast. Blanche gets a bonus at work and decides to get her breasts enlarged. That's kind of like rearranging the decks on the Titanic, or deck chairs on the Titanic. Yeah, I mean, don't you have grandkids to send birthday money to or something? Are we really in approaching 70 going to get our breasts done? I don't know. Let's take a little pause here, because so far Blanche has had a pregnancy scare and a tough decision to make regarding breast enhancement surgery. It's kind of hard to tell. Is this the story of a woman in her 60s or the plot to an ABC after school special? They're really blurring the lines here. Okay, let's go back to it. S5E5, love under the big top. Dorothy is dating a lawyer played by the legendary Dick Van Dyke, who wants to give up his law practice and become a circus clown. In short, he dated Dorothy and then wants to run away with the circus. Yeah, I get it. That sounds about right. S5E6, dancing in the dark. Rose feels inferior to the college professor she's dating. Having heard her St. Olaf stories, I'm with her. She is inferior. Rose, you're run with that instinct. You are correct. S5E8, that old feeling. Blanche falls in love with her late husband's brother, Jamie. Seriously, no fucking boundaries with this lady. Holy Jesus. Blanche falls in love with her late husband's brother, Jamie. Jamie, obviously a stand-up guy, knows it's only because he reminds her so much of her late husband and kindly refuses her advances. They remain friends. He remains disease-free. Well done, Jamie. You're going to live a couple more years. S5, E13. Mary has a little lamb. Blanche regrets writing love letters to a man in prison when he gets released and robs their Miami home. Really? Is that what it took to realize writing sexy letters to men in the can is a bad idea? Establish some fucking boundaries, Blanche. Also, there's a subplot in this episode about a pregnant teenager played by Julie McCulloch. They never come right out and say it, but I'm guessing the father is that scumbag Scott Baio. That's a callback to the last episode. I like Julie McCulloch. Let's take a look here. S5, E14, Great Expectations. Blanche's 7,000th boyfriend has a heart attack, causing Blanche to be reminded of her late husband's death. This results in her fearing to commit to him and refusing to visit him in the hospital. By the time she goes to see him, he's already reconciled with his wife. Heartbroken, Blanche doesn't date again until later. Until later. That's funny. S5, E15, Triple Play. There are two romantic storylines going on in this episode. First, Blanche rents a car and pretends to be selling it to meet men. Because meeting men has been a struggle in the past, I think she has a few stowed away in her fucking closet, for fuck's sake. Ugh. Anyway, interestingly, this scheme ended up getting Dorothy a date. You come for the car, but you stay for the tall chick, right? You come for the car, but you stay for the tall chick? No? I'll rework that line. Also, the daughter of Rose's squeeze, Miles, asks Rose to stay away from him, right? To stay away from my dad. Apparently, she doesn't think he's done grieving the loss of his late wife. Rose responds with, well, his dick says otherwise. At least that's what she would have said had I written the episode. S5, E17, like the beep, beep, beep of the tom-tom. After having a pacemaker put in, Blanche is afraid of ever having sex again. until she starts having sex again and again and again and again. And like Rose, sometimes standing up. S5, E20, twice in a lifetime. A former boyfriend of Rose's, a man she hasn't seen in 40 years, shows up and asks her to come to Europe with him. I get it. Making a booty call to an ex is normal. But Europe? After 40 years? My man must be desperate as hell. I mean, I made some booty calls, but not after 40 years and offering them a trip to Europa. S5, E22, cheaters. Remember when Dorothy was having an affair with a married man way back in season one? Well, he's back and he's divorced. And in keeping with this show's history, he proposes. The good news is that Dorothy is finally on the board with our marriage proposal, which will tally up the scores. The bad news is that she's tied with her mom. So she gets her first marriage proposal, but she's tied with her own mom. Okay, so only two seasons left. Let's pause again. Let's tally up the scores again. Here are the results through five seasons. Number of boyfriends slash dates and or sexual partners. Blanche is at 14. Dorothy at 9. Rose is at 10. And Sophia is at 4. Number of marriage proposals. Blanche has 2. Sophia, 1. And I believe Dorothy has 1, right? Did I not mark that down? And let's take a look. And Dorothy has 1, so she's tied. Number of marriages, though, Sophia 1. The others none so far. So how about that? Huh? Sophia actually has a marriage on the board. It's a tight race. Let's just finish out the series and get our final results. Two seasons left, folks. S6, E6, feelings. Rose is concerned that her dentist may have behaved improperly while she was under sedation. Dentistry can be confusing. There's so many extractions, crowns, molars, panties. S6, E7, is born again. Stan and Dorothy hook up, resulting in Stan's wanting a full-blown reconciliation. Dorothy wisely fends him off, proving that beggars can in fact be choosers. I was wrong there earlier. Okay. S6, E9, Mrs. George Devereaux. Blanche's late husband, oh boy, Blanche's late husband, believed to have been dead for years, shows up and claims to have faked his own death. Meanwhile, Dorothy is caught in a love triangle with two celebrities, Sonny Bono and Lyle Wagner. We have officially jumped the sharks, folks. Faked his death? Right? That's some Melrose Place shit. And B. Arthur being pursued by two famous men? That's even crazier. So that's our jump the shark moment. S6, E9. Well done, Golden Girls. S6, E10. Girls just want to have fun before they die. I didn't make that up. That's actually the name of the title, but it sounds like one of my stupid jokes. Sophia asks Blanche for tips on how to please her boyfriend. Here's a tip. Don't be 84 years old. He'll love that. Stop being 84. Men don't like that. S6, E11. Stand by your man. Blanche makes a date with a man she met at the library, not realizing he's confined to a wheelchair. Of course, it takes a while for her to warm up to the idea. When she does finally embrace it, it turns out that he's married. That's why I've always said, never trust those bastards in wheelchairs. Liars. Well, the other half are just lazy. I think they don't like to walk. Especially the ones that go to Disney World, apparently. S6, either, because Disney World, if you've ever been to Disney World, you know what I'm talking about, those fucking scooters. It's like, I didn't know if being fat was a handicap. S6, E13. The bloom is off the rose. Blanche finds herself in an abusive relationship, but not with the wheelchair guy. Sure, he gave him his walking papers. Get it? She gave him his walking papers. She's on to a new guy now. S6, E15, miles to go. Rose learns that her boyfriend Miles is really Nicholas Carbone, a mob witness relocated to Miami by the Witness Protection Program. This is stupid on several levels. But the worst part is that he will continue to appear on this show as Miles, and no one ever mentions this again. Come on, writers, at least commit to this nonsense. This isn't Lost. Previously, on Lost. No one fucking knows. S6, E16, and E17, another two-parter. There Goes the Bride, parts 1 and 2. Dorothy and Stan decide to remarry. I would say that Dorothy needs to stop all this sex with the ex, but let's face it, she needs to get it where she can. I mean, B. Arthur has to get it where she can. S6, E19, melodrama. Blanche is dating a new guy who stops returning her calls. After not hearing back from him, she assumes he's dead, because no living man would ever ghost Miami's sexiest woman, right? Well, it turns out he was just out of town, and he reaches out to her when he gets back. The fear that he had died now causes her to want to get super serious with him, but he pushes back. Maybe it's because he went out of town for the weekend and came back to 176 messages on his fucking answering machine, right? Stalker alert! Of course he's fucking afraid of her now. S6, E20, even grandmas get the blues. In order to land a fella she likes, Blanche pretends her granddaughter is actually her own child. Yes, because that's what a guy wants, an old chick raising a baby. Because that's the better choice? No. S6, E21, witness. Having ended things with Miles, Rose is moving on with a new boyfriend. Things get complicated when Miles returns, especially when we learn that Rose's new boyfriend is actually a criminal that sent Miles into hiding. Remember, he's in the Witness Protection Program. This results in a Reservoir Dogs-style Mexican standoff where Mr. Pink gets away with the diamonds. Or maybe I fell asleep and dreamed that last part, but that's how it should have ended. S6, E23, love for sale. Stan, apparently unable to fuck anyone else in the great state of Florida, uses a charity auction to win a date with his ex-wife, Dorothy. Luckily, it only cost a few bucks. B. Arthur. S7, E5, where's Charlie? Blanche dates a baseball player. Okay, more specifically, Blanche is coaching said baseball player and suggests he wear her panties for luck. Yeah, I liked it better when it was called Bull Durham and Tim Robbins was wearing Susan Sarandon's underwear. Come on, Golden Girls, step up the writing. S7, E6, but I'm losing my voice. This is so many episodes, I'm losing my fucking voice. S7, E6, motherlode. Blanche has a new boyfriend for the 1,000th time. This flavor of boyfriend has a controlling mother and comedy ensues, as does herpes. Herpes ensues. S7, E7, Dateline, Miami. Dorothy goes on a date. Woohoo! While she's out getting hers, the other three bust out the cheesecake and reminisce about some of their most notable dates. I love Sophia's story about dating Clark from Lewis and Clark. Because she's so old. Clark from Lewis and Clark? That's funny. S7, E8, The Monkey Show. Dorothy catches her sister in bed with Stan, forcing everyone to ask, just how big is this man schlong? Right? Everyone's fucking this guy. He's like the Tony Maselli of Miami. Oh my gosh. S7, E9, Rose loves Miles. Rose is annoyed with Miles because he is cheap. Not because he has a fake identity, is in the Witness Protection Program, and has left her for months at a time. No. Because he's cheap. Blanche offers emotional support the only way she knows how, by taking Rose out on a double date with two big spenders. What good is being wealthy if you can't spend it on Blanche and Rose, right? I'm a wealthy, successful guy in Miami. Let me go out with Blanche and Rose. S7, E11, From Here to the Pharmacy. That's a good title. From Here to the Pharmacy. A soldier returning from the Persian Gulf sweeps Blanche off her feet. To be fair, getting Blanche off her feet is pretty easy, though. So stop bragging about it, fella. S7, E13, Old Boyfriends. Okay, a lot going on in this episode. First, Rose gets a visit from an old boyfriend from her St. Olaf days, but she has no recollection of having dated him because she dated a lot of men when she was young. I'm sure her dead husband is super proud of that. Meanwhile, Sophia finds the perfect man via a classified ad, only to find that his dying wife is looking for her own replacement so he won't be lonely when she croaks. Wow, that's so sad to make fun of. Let's just laugh at how much of a whore Rose was in St. Olaf. We'll laugh at that part. We'll be sensitive about the Sophia one. That's a tough one. But Rose was a whore. S7, E15, The Commitments. Blanche worries that her beauty is fading when a man she is dating doesn't want to sleep with her. It turns out he just wants to take things slow. No need to rush into an STD. Meanwhile, Dorothy is dating a guy that portrays George in the show Beatlemania. George? Like for Dorothy? Come on. Ringo, maybe. But she's not bagging George. That's not happening. S7, E19, A Midwinter Night's Dream. There's a full moon out, so Blanche throws a party inviting tons of men because she thinks the full moon will make them horny. I'm not making this up at all. Later, Sophia witnesses Dorothy kissing Rose's man, Miles. Miles kissing Dorothy? I think Blanche was onto something with her full moon theory, right? I mean, to make a man want to kiss B. Arthur, that's some serious moon shit right there. S7, E20. Rose, A Portrait of a Woman. Blanche convinces Rose to give Miles a sexy picture of herself for his birthday. Upon viewing the picture, Miles calls the... Blanche convinces Rose to give Miles a sexy picture of herself for his birthday. Upon viewing the picture, Miles calls the mafia to give them his exact location. Come kill me, guys. Come shoot me. I'm here. I'm waiting. I'm making myself laugh. S7E23. This is the final one. One Flew Out of the Cuckoo's Nest. The series finale. Dorothy gets married to Leslie Nielsen. Stan never has sex again. Leslie Nielsen never enjoys sex again. Boom. Done. All right, let's tally our final numbers. I'll go in order here. Number of boyfriends, dates, and or sexual partners. In the lead, the winner, Blanche, with 23. Second place, shockingly, Dorothy with 16. Rose with 14. And Sophia with 6. Now, 6 doesn't sound like a lot, but for a woman well into her 80s, 6 is a pretty damn good number. Number of marriage proposals. Blanche and Dorothy are tied with 2. Sophia has 1. Rose doesn't get any of this thing. Number of marriages. Sophia 1. Dorothy 1. So that, my friends, is a wrap on the Golden Girls. Possibly, just quite possibly, the horniest TV show of all time. And now we're going to turn our attention to The Cosby Show. Oh boy. The Cosby Show. I'm not sure where to start. I remember talking to my mother back in the early 2000s about The Cosby Show. I was holding court in a restaurant, you know, rambling on about television shows that I loved. And of course, I had to mention this 80s staple of my childhood. Knowing that my family and financial experience growing up was vastly different than that of the Huxtables, my mom was understandably curious as how I could even relate to the show. She wondered why I didn't just serve as a reminder to the type of life I didn't have, you know, which would be consistency, wealth, you know, the same dad every year, etc. I didn't have an answer beyond, I just loved that show. For years afterwards, I thought about this conversation. I clearly couldn't relate at all to this show, but for some reason, this didn't bother me. It didn't affect my adoration for the show at all. And then one day, it occurred to me, it was perfectly normal for me to not relate to the show, but to still love it dearly because no one can relate to this fucking freak show. White people can't. Black people can't relate. Rich people, poor people, foreigners, inanimate objects. This show is a mystery to everyone because it is quietly the strangest sitcom in television history and one whose legacy, sadly, makes Scott Baio look like Michael fucking Landon. But I'll get to that later. The Cosby Show premiered as part of NBC's Thursday night lineup on September 20th, 1984. It lasted 197 episodes over 8 seasons until it bid us adieu on April 30th, 1992. Words can hardly describe how big of a phenomenon this show was. I mean, if you don't know, you don't know. It practically defined the 80s, it defined 80s television and single-handedly revived the family sitcom. It spent 5 consecutive years as the number one rated show on television, all of television, right? And according to TV Guide, it was TV's biggest hit of the 1980s. The premise was simple. A successful doctor with an epic sweater collection is married to an equally successful lawyer. They have 4 kids and live in a beautiful brownstone in Brooklyn. The kids are pretty well behaved and will go on to remain virgins until they marry. No one in this family has ever or ever will get divorced. Wait, but then there's a 5th child we didn't know about, Sandra. She's the oldest, but has been away to her Ivy League college. I mentioned that dad is a doctor. More specifically, he's a gyno with an office in the basement. The family is black, but appears to not experience any racism ever in New York City in the 80s. The mom is pretty hot, is always dressed to the nines, and speaks 2 languages. The house is huge and spotless. They keep moving people into the house, so there appears to be limitless bedrooms. Every kid graduates from college, and if they don't, they get fired. I'm looking at you, Lisa Bonet. There's very little alcohol, absolutely no smoking or drugs, and the jazz flows like the mighty Mississippi. Just like every American family, right? You with me? The Cosby Show had a simple premise, which was the stand-up comedy of Bill Cosby. By the early 80s, Bill's television and movie career kind of slowed down a bit. In 1983, he released the legendary stand-up special, Bill Cosby Himself. This special was a huge hit, and it focused almost solely on the trials and tribulations of being a parent. Excuse me. Everyone loved this special, including producers Marcy Carsey and Tom Werner, who had recently left ABC to start their own production company, Carsey Werner. Wisely, they felt that Cosby's take on family life and fatherhood would make a great family sitcom. Cosby agreed, but his initial vision differed from the final product. His first thought was to have the parents be blue-collar, he a limo driver and she an electrician. Boy, did he pull a 180 on that, huh? Because then it became doctor and lawyer. Along the way, he realized that this could be an amazing platform to portray African-American families, rather. An amazing platform to portray these families as successful and educated. With a background in education himself, he has a doctorate in education. Cosby turned to Alvin Poussant. He's a Harvard professor of psychiatry and associate dean for student affairs at the medical school. He turned to him to develop and consult on each episode of the show. The goal was to create a show that would be healthy for all children, especially black children. The focus was on creating positive images of parenting and marriage with a lot of father involvement. They didn't want to resort to the buffoonery of previous black sitcoms like The Jeffersons or Good Times. And by the way, to be clear, buffoonery was their word and not mine. It was also important that they prioritize American culture African culture as part, such as art and music. Interestingly though, race was rarely ever part of a storyline. Isn't it interesting that a show created by a black man, starring an almost all black cast and featuring tons of black art and music, isn't really a black show? I had tons of black friends growing up, and they all loved The Cosby Show, but I don't think they could relate to it. I had tons of white friends too, and again, they all loved the show, but they didn't relate to it. No. Why? Because like I said earlier, it's fucking weird. But more on that later. I promise we'll get to the fun stuff. Let's look at the cast first, shall we? Bill Cosby as the patriarch, Dr. Heathcliff Huxtable. His full name is Heathcliff Aloysius Huxtable. Pretty common name, actually. Dr. Huxtable is an OBGYN. When not delivering babies, he can be found looking dumbfounded by his family or napping on the couch. Felicia Ayers Allen, later Felicia Rashad, when she married former NFLer Ahmad Rashad, she played Claire Huxtable. Claire is a no-nonsense lawyer who always looks great. Like her husband, she makes being successful, career-minded professional, and parent look way too easy. Far too easy, in fact. I mean, it's almost as though this show is 100% full of shit, which maybe it is. Sabrina LaBeouf, she came up in our Boof episodes. She was a Boof candidate. Sabrina LaBeouf as oldest child, Sandra. Sandra got married about 45 seconds after graduating college. Her husband was a misogynistic douche, so I'm guessing she married him so quickly so she could like shed that pesky virginity, which they all tend to do. Eventually, she will study to be a lawyer like her mom while her husband becomes a doctor like her dad. Lisa Bonet as Denise. Denise is the black sheep. First, she's a kooky teenager. You know, then she drops out of college. Then she does a TNA movie with Mickey Rourke and later gets knocked up by Lenny Kravitz. Wait. I'm blurring the lines here between Denise and Lisa Bonet. Regardless, Cliff didn't like either of them. He didn't like Lisa Bonet or Denise Huxtable. Her only saving grace is that she, too, waited until marriage to have sex. That's one rule no Huxtable will break, I promise you. Malcolm Jamal Warner as only son Theo. His middle name is also Aloysius. Theodore Aloysius Huxtable. Ugh. Theo's crime is being a piss-poor student in high school who somehow gets into NYU where he becomes an outstanding student, all the while avoiding premarital sex, just like the rest of them. Well done, Theo. Tempest Bledsoe is daughter Vanessa. Vanessa is the most defiant of the children, and on more than one occasion came mighty close to having Claire slap the fucking taste out of her mouth. Later, Vanessa would go to college, get engaged to an older campus maintenance man, yet still avoid that devilish premarital booty. They're all good at that. Keisha Knight Pulliam as youngest child Rudy. Rudy was super cute. Until she wasn't, and they had to pull a Cousin Oliver on her via Raven Simone as Denise's stepdaughter, Olivia. So that's a big once-over on the cast. Let's pause quickly. Okay, I'm back. Had to get a drink of water there. So, you know, overall, the cast was great. I mean, interestingly, though, none of them went on to do great things after the show ended. Maybe it's the curse of having been on an iconic show and being so identified with the character they portrayed. Or maybe it's because, like the show, the cast was strange as hell, too. Here's an example. In 2002, the cast reunited for a Cosby Show reunion during which they were like, you know, each interviewed and they reminisced about their time on the show and they showed classic clips, blah, blah, blah. What jumped out at me though was how all the child actors, now grown up and in their 30s, mind you, kept referring to Bill Cosby as Mr. Cosby. What the fuck is that about? I can understand a 14-year-old Malcolm Jamal Warner being told to refer to his elders as Mr. and Mrs., you know. Not that he ever once referred to Felicia Rashad, by the way, as Mrs. during that reunion. It was never Mrs. Rashad. It was Felicia and Mr. Cosby. But I get a 14-year-old being asked to do that. But this is years later. He's well into his 30s, and he's now, you know, a colleague of Bill Cosby. He's not a subordinate. His colleague. Fuck all that Mr. Cosby shit. I mean, it sounds like a cult. Should I get into the crazy shit now and get it over with? Nah. Let's do some housekeeping first. I'm going to make you wait for it like you're one of the Huxtable kids because they had to wait for it. Let's talk intros. One of the most fun things about this show is that it changes intro each season. Season one was pretty bland, just like a family picnic, you know, they're all there. They kick things up a notch, though, for season two by having Bill Cosby dancing with each member of the family. And of course, he's a goofy dancer and it's really funny. I don't know why, but I loved this as a kid. The reveal each year of the new intro was like my Christmas. Right? Every year, new intro, I'd be excited to see it. Seasons two through four were different variations of Bill dancing with the other cast members. In season five, all hell broke loose when they decided to go with like a tropical theme. I mean, surely they can never top that, until they did for season six and seven when Bill danced with everyone in front of the like a big Apollo Theater sign. And at the end of it, he uttered those famous words, this is the best elevator music I ever heard. Love that. And then Bill, maybe realizing it was now the 90s and his show wasn't hip anymore, not that it was ever really hip, right? He decided to do a decidedly more urban theme. So Bill would still be dancing like a jackass with everyone, but he would now be doing it in front of a mural called Street of Dreams. Unfortunately, Bill didn't have permission to use this mural. It was painted by students for the Creative Arts Workshop for Homeless Children, and it depicted children playing and laughing. But they wouldn't be playing and laughing anymore when old Bill was accused of not giving them credit. Lawyers got involved, Bill got pissed and pulled the intro, and they went back to the Apollo Theater one until the show ended in 1992. So a lot of drama there. But it was kind of urban and, you know, more of a hip-hop feel, because, I mean, Bill Cosby was finally seeing the writing on the wall. I don't know. Might as well make it a black show. But how about common sitcom tropes? Was the Cosby Show able to attract some big-time guest stars? You tell me. Wallace Shawn was recurring. That's pretty cool. A pre-SNL Adam Sandler was also recurring. Not too shabby. Stevie Wonder, Sammy Davis Jr., B.B. King, Lena Horne, Danny Kaye, Red Buttons, E.G. Marshall, and Christopher Plummer also appeared as well. So yeah, they could play the guest star game at a pretty high level. Did The Cosby Show have spinoffs? You bet. But they tried for more than you may know about. Let's first discuss the possible spinoffs that failed to launch. There's a lot going on here. A lot of people don't know about this stuff. So S1E23 was Mr. Quiet. This episode focused on the Huxtables spending the day at a community center run by singer Tony Orlando. Dr. Huxtable is there to teach an expectant mother class. Interestingly, one of the expectant mothers was played by an unknown Angela Bassett. But this episode, the reason I'm talking about it, this episode was a backdoor pilot for a proposed show starring Tony Orlando. It never came into fruition. S7E15, Total Control. Cliff's patient and her husband, played by real-life couple Amy Yazbeck and John Ritter, are having a baby very soon, and they claim to have everything under control, as most new parents tend to do. Of course, all hell breaks loose when she goes into labor and John Ritter runs around doing his physical comedy, like Jack Tripper type of thing, you know. This too was a backdoor pilot. Like Tony Orlando, John Ritter's proposed new show never happened either. Then there's S7, E24, and E25. This to me is one of the more interesting ones. And the episodes were Theo and the Kids Parts 1 and 2. Theo starts a job as a volunteer at a community center. Now that Tony Orlando has been hauled off to prison, I'm assuming. I don't know what happened to him. But the kids have a bunch of problems, though. And Theo somehow is able to help all of them, and probably because he has refrained from premarital sex. I'm thinking that makes you good at stuff. NBC felt that this would be a good basis for a spinoff for the Theo character once The Cosby Show ended. Malcolm Jamal Warner liked the idea, and in one of the wisest moments in television history, demanded that he do the show not as Theo, but as a completely different character. So to be clear, He didn't want to be associated with a beloved character from one of the biggest sitcoms in history and bring in with him an instant fan base. No. He wanted to simply cruise in on the Malcolm Jamal Warner charisma train and do this thing on his own. How did it go, you ask? It premiered in 1992 as Here and Now and lasts only 13 episodes. Malcolm Jamal Warner was last seen making roast beef Sammies at Arby's. Stupid decision, Malcolm Jamal. Stupid decision. But Bill Cosby still produced it, by the way. And that's a wrap on the spinoffs that didn't happen. Of course, one major spinoff did happen. A Different World. This show followed Huxtable daughter Denise as she went off to Hillman College, which was like an HBCU, and her parents' alma mater, actually, Hillman College. A bona fide hit, it lasted six seasons from 1987 until 1993 and gave us 144 episodes, of which star Lisa Bonet only appeared in 23. 23 of 144. Why only 23? Well, as I mentioned earlier, she got knocked up by Lenny Kravitz. And boss man Bill Cosby was not going to write that shit into the show, so she got canned and went back to being a recurring character on The Cosby Show. Interestingly, though, the show wasn't even initially intended to be a Cosby Show spinoff. It was originally conceived to be centered on the character of Maggie, portrayed by Marissa Tomei, and would tell the story of a white student in a historically black college. That idea got scrapped. Lisa Bonet came on as the lead, and the rest is history. So, after the pregnancy, Lisa Bonet is out. Marissa Tomei decides to leave as well. In real life, they were roommates, by the way. So, Lisa Bonet is gone. Marissa Tomei is gone. And she goes and pursues her Oscar-caliber career. So, well done. Now, normally, this would be a show killer. But this is where A Different World actually really came to life. Jasmine Guy's character of Whitley Gilbert stepped up as the lead. The other supporting characters would also rise to the occasion. And the show took off. In the end, Lenny Kravitz not pulling out was the best thing that ever could have happened to the students of Hillman, right? And that's one to grow on. Bum, 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 bum. Okay, enough spinoff talk. Let's talk Cousin Oliver. As the youngest children tend to do, little Rudy Huxtable grew up and became even less interesting than she already was. The Cosby Show's ratings were slipping, and The Simpsons was the new sheriff in town. That was the first show to ever knock Cosby out of number one. So desperate to claw its way back, and the show gave Denise a naval officer husband that she met in Africa and a cute little stepdaughter named Olivia that was portrayed by Raven Simone. Little side note, it was later confirmed that Denise was still a virgin when she hurriedly married this stranger in Africa, lest any of you were worried. And that's going to come up again later. I just have to keep bringing that up. I'll tie this all together, I promise you. Now, I'm not normally a sucker for cute kids on sitcoms, but Olivia was chock full personality. I really have to hand it to Raven Simone. She was pretty cute. I really like that kid. Sadly, she didn't breathe much new life, though, into the show, especially when you consider the television landscape of the 90s and the audience's desire for more mature themes. In case I haven't made it clear, mature themes was not in this show's wheelhouse, okay? So sensing that the audience might be more interested in high school issues and maybe a black person who's having a black experience in America, this show then brought in Cousin Pam, played by Erica Alexander. Now, Pam is from a more urban part of NYC, has more urban friends, and thus experiences more urban issues, okay? She moves in with the Huxtables so they can knock that urban right out of her. Luckily, the house and its limitless bedrooms can easily accommodate Pam. Unluckily, her character failed to make much of an impact, and the show ended anyway. But this was a valiant effort by the show to try and Cousin Oliver, and to kind of bring the show into the 90s a little bit. We'll get to the creepy underbelly of the show, I promise. I promise, promise, promise. But first, let's examine the lack of housekeeping. How do the Huxtables not employ a housekeeper? At any given time, they had at least six people living in the house, sometimes more when in-laws, kids, or cousins would move in, but never less than six. Yet the house was spotless, the kitchen pristine, the sofa pillows always where they were supposed to be, and I call bullshit. And where were these people crapping? We see two bathrooms. One is the master bath for Cliff and Claire. The other is upstairs for the four or five or six other people? And no wet towels anywhere? I have four full bathrooms for my family of four. And it always looks like I'm harboring a fucking fleet of refugees. Towels askew, no toilet paper, a sink full of toothpaste, a mirror full of fucking toothpaste. I mean, we haven't even mentioned food yet. I know we see both Cliff and Claire cooking sometimes, but several meals a day for at least six people is a lot of work. The fridge appears to be organized, the sink is empty, the stove bare of pots and pans. I think the Huxtables might be aliens, and based on their behavior, I might be right. So let's examine. Did it make sense that the Huxtables did not have a full-time live-in housekeeper? Not at all. They would need a full-time, no-nonsense, full-service servant to do the cooking, cleaning, shopping, and laundry for this ever-expanding group of people, not to mention the sweater shopping. The sweater shopping alone for Dr. Huxtable is a full-time job. Did the housekeepers take too many liberties? N.A. Was he a surrogate parent? N.A. Did he do a good job? N.A. So their grade, much like the Golden Girls, is incomplete. You don't even get it. You don't even qualify for an F because you didn't finish. Okay. I know I keep promising to get to the CD side of this show. We're getting close, I promise. First, I want to point out some episodes. Keep in mind how I am conflicted when it comes to The Cosby Show. I loved this show, despite its oddball nature and now horrible legacy. Normally, I would find some episodes to goof on. But since we're about to take a massive dump on this show later, I thought I would highlight some episodes that I genuinely love. So enjoy. So first one, S1E5, A Shirt Story. Cliff does not allow Theo to buy an expensive shirt, so Denise steps in to make him an exact replica. Of course, it turns out to be a train wreck. Cliff, though, delivers one of my favorite lines of all time when he tells Theo, "No 14-year-old boy should have a $95 shirt unless he's on stage with his four brothers." I always loved that line. It always made me laugh. Jackson 5 reference. That was a horrible Cliff Huxtable impression. More of those are coming, so enjoy. S1E9, How Ugly Is He? Cliff and Claire are annoyed by Denise's new boyfriend's arrogant attitude. This episode is full of classic lines. The new boyfriend, David James is his name, is explaining to Cliff and Theo that he doesn't believe in grades and does not plan to attend college because he wants to go find himself. Cliff is thoroughly annoyed, like any dad would be. Meanwhile, Theo is eating it up. Here's some lines. So David James, "See, I've been reading Socrates and he believed that true learning comes from just observing the world." Theo, "Where can I find that book?" Cliff responds, "You don't read, son." Theo's like, "Well, maybe there's a movie about it." I love that. Then later on, Cliff, "So if you're not going to college, then what are you going to do?" David James, "I thought I'd spend some time trying to find myself." "How much time do you think that's going to take?" "About 5 or 10 years." "Well, you'd be able to find yourself plus a couple more people, don't you think?" I love that. Then later when Denise checks in with her dad, "So daddy, how do you like David?" "I don't know if that's him. He hasn't found himself yet." It's pretty classic stuff. I know it doesn't translate well with me doing a horrible reading of it. You would never know that I was an actor for a while, but you probably understand why I'm not an actor anymore. S2E3, Happy Anniversary. The Huxtables celebrate Cliff's parents' 49th wedding anniversary, which culminates in them lip-syncing the Ray Charles classic, "Nighttime is the Right Time." Watching Rudy lip-sync the phrase "baby" over and over again is worth the price of admission. Young Fanicek was in tears with laughter, and I cannot impress upon you enough like how popular this episode was. I mean, I remember going to school. I would have been in, probably second grade at the time. And like all of us were like, "baby, baby." It was just really, really funny stuff. Look it up on the YouTubes. S2E4, Cliff in Love. Sandra and her boyfriend, Elvin, break up for like the umpteenth time. So her parents encourage her to go on a date with another fella named Daryl. Cliff ends up loving the guy and tries to coach him up as a possible replacement for Elvin. There are also some great lines in this episode. So Cliff talking to Sandra, he's like, "Why do you keep going back to this boy?" "Well, Dad, because he's wonderful. He's intelligent. He has a good sense of humor. We have a great time together." "When?" That always made me laugh. Later, Cliff is on the couch with the new guy, Daryl. Daryl's like, "Who's Elvin?" "Elvin is the fella she likes." Daryl's like, "Oh, then why am I here?" "Because you're the fellow I like." And as a dad, I can totally get it. S2E14, Vanessa's bad grade. Vanessa borrows a sweater from Denise, even though Denise has told her not to. This results in them getting into a physical altercation, like a real fight. Trying to break it up, Cliff gets tossed to the floor, leading him to muse to himself, "They took me out." Now, this was fun to watch, but not very believable, or so I thought. Now that I'm old, I have two daughters, I've had similar things happen to me. My daughter's going at it, and me on the floor, like basically fearing for my safety as I try to stop them from fighting, I get kicked in the head. So it's real. Getting old is not for the weak. S2E18, A Touch of Wonder. Denise and Theo get into a fender bender with the limousine of none other than Stevie Wonder. Don't worry, he wasn't driving. As often happens after a car accident, Stevie invited the entire family to visit him at the recording studio where they all got to record little sound bites. Claire, already super unrelatable, turns out to be a great singer and duets with Stevie on I Just Called to Say I Love You. He sends them home with a recording that they will cherish forever, or for at least until the end of this episode. I think we never hear about it again. S2E22, Theo's Holiday. Theo's life plan involves leaving home at 18 to pursue a modeling career that will make him wealthy, making school totally unnecessary. This makes me wonder if Theo has ever seen a male model. Also, has Theo ever seen Theo? Anyway, to prove he knows nothing about the real world and how it works, the Huxtable clan empties his bedroom completely, pretends their house is an apartment complex, and they each play different roles in order to teach Theo a valuable lesson about life and survival. The show is teaching us that Theo's plan is unrealistic, while also teaching us that two professionals, a doctor and a lawyer, and three of their children have enough time, desire, and energy in their lives to do this type of shit. And where do they put Theo's furniture? In one of the two bathrooms? I mean, I make fun, but it's still one of my favorite episodes, and it ends with Theo eating his favorite food, a bacon burger dog, which to this day I've never had, a bacon burger dog. I think I'm going to have a bacon burger dog tonight. Woman, make me a bacon burger dog. She's not home. I would never say that to her. S5E12, Cliff babysits. Cliff babysits his twin grandchildren, Winnie and Nelson. Yes, Winnie and Nelson, right? Nelson Mandela, Winnie Mandela. Anyway, so Cliff babysits his two grandchildren, Winnie and Nelson, while the family is at a Michael Jackson concert. This episode is largely forgettable, but it is worth watching Bill Cosby because he's clearly improvising through much of the episode while working with the two babies. It's actually pretty impressive because like the babies keep looking up at the ceiling. So they're clearly looking at the studio lights and all that. And Cliff like gets down low with them on the floor to see what they're looking at. Improv is not easy. So my hat's off to anyone who does it with babies for an audience of millions. So really well done. Fun to watch. S5E15. No way, baby. Cliff's patient is a young, unwed teenager with no family. Hoping to find someone who can help her, Cliff tracks down her grandfather, Ray Palomino, played by Sammy Davis Jr. Ray is a character, both charming and funny, but something is amiss. We soon discover that this man can't read. So just when you think it's going to be a message around not becoming a teen mom, they pull a quick U-turn and make it about literacy. Good idea. There's a teenager and laborer over here, but we're going to focus our time and energy on the 64-year-old who can't fucking read. I don't know. Weird choice. S6, E19, Mr. Sandman. Cliff takes Rudy to her tap dance class and ends up getting into a tap battle with the legendary Howard Sandman Sims. This never fails to make me laugh. So if you don't know, Sandman Sims is called Sandman Sims because like he'll throw sands on the floor and like do tap dancing and scratching with the sands, and he makes all these cool sounds. And he was always on Showtime at the Apollo. I remember that as a kid watching. He was always on that. So where the hell was I? Anyway, Sandman Sims is doing his thing while Dr. Huxtable is just like making shit up, tap dancing. And like the leech do like some tap dancing and yell, challenge. So then Bill Cosby do his challenge, like just challenging each other. By the end, Cliff is exhausted and he's like just picking up the chair and like moving the chair around to make tap dancing noises. But do yourself a favor, look it up. You'll thoroughly enjoy it, provided you can try and forget that Bill Cosby is likely a rapist. If you can erase that from your brain, you're going to like this episode. S6 E20. Isn't it romantic? Cliff, Martin, and Elvin argue over who is the most romantic of the three. They design a contest wherein each of them will buy their wife a romantic gift for less than $25. Each man will present their gift to their wife at dinner, and the man who elicits the most romantic response from their wife will earn the title of the Emperor of Romance, proving once again that these motherfuckers have a lot of time on their hands. This proves to be a layup for Cliff, being as $25 buys a lot of date rape drugs. Zinger! Okay, in all seriousness, all three men knock it out of the park, but Cliff's is amazing. It's like Kate Hudson-level rom-com amazing. You should check it out. It's actually a fun episode. S7 E1, same time next year. It's the first day of school, and Rudy wants to stay home because her boobs haven't grown as much as her friends did over the summer. Pretty forgettable episode, but as one of my favorite Cosby Show lines, Rudy says to her dad, "This is woman stuff. I really need to talk to mom." Cliff responds with, "I'm a gynecologist, and you want to talk to a lawyer?" Anyway, I thought that was funny. Wow, in hindsight, though, it's actually creepy. I wonder how many times Bill Cosby has tried to play gynecologist with a woman who's begging for her lawyer. We're getting closer to the fun stuff, kids. S8, E24, and so we commence. The series finale, April 30th, 1992. Interestingly, the show ended with Cliff and Claire breaking the fourth wall and dancing off into the studio. It was sweet. It really was. But enough sweetness. As promised, let's get down to the nasty nitty-gritty. This show has aged horribly for very obvious reasons. As of 2024, more than 60 women have accused Bill Cosby of rape, sexual assault, drug-facilitated sexual assault, sexual misconduct, and sexual abuse. There are also two allegations of child sexual abuse, both involving 15-year-old girls. The accusations range from the mid-1960s to as late as 2008. It's over 40 years of abuse. It's pretty hard to watch The Cosby Show and still enjoy it, knowing that, you know, what was likely going on behind the scenes, and it's largely been removed from syndication. So like, it's literally like hard to watch The Cosby Show now. The show was already preachy, and knowing that these allegations exist make it very hard to stomach all of Cosby's holier-than-thou horseshit. That said, I'm not going to do a deep dive on the sexual allegations. You can look that up on your own if you want to learn more. What I will do, though, is shine a light on some aspects of this show that were already really fucking strange, some of which are now completely unsettling given what we now know about the cause and his sexual predilections. So let's start with Bill Cosby's ego. This fucker clearly thinks very highly of himself, doesn't he? I remember as a kid being confused by the credits when I would see the name Dr. William H. Cosby Jr., EDD, listed as one of the creators. I was young. I assumed it was a relative at first. Nope. This dude goes by plain old Bill when credited as an actor, but when it comes to listing his name as co-creator, he wants to remind all of us that he has a PhD in education. There isn't anything inherently wrong with that, but if you had a friend who was doing that, you'd call them out on their douche shit, right? Like, come on, because that's kind of a douchey thing to do, right? I'm Fanichek to my friends, but I'm Dr. William H. Fanichek Jr., EDD, everywhere else. I don't know. I think it sucks. Later, as I mentioned earlier, while doing a reunion special in 2002, the former child actors, now grown-ass adults, all referred to him as Mr. Cosby. Now, I'd be fine with it if I thought they were doing it by choice, but I have to imagine that this came down from on high. Thou shalt not refer to thy God as Bill. Also, shouldn't it be Dr. Cosby? I mean, we know the motherfucker loves his PhD. I'm shocked he doesn't have them call him Dr. Cosby. Now, as an avid viewer of The Cosby Show, I have long been compiling a list of baffling shit that this show has done. In no particular order, I present to you this list I like to call Weird Cosby Show Shit. That's just a working title. Okay, up first. This show premiered in 1984, which means it was developed in 1983, which was a fairly conservative time in American culture, you know, particularly in television. How is it that when deciding Cliff Huxtable's profession, they landed on gynecologist? I mean, think about this. Doctor makes sense. Maybe a family doctor. Better yet, how about a pediatrician? I mean, he's great with kids. He's already done children's television. So let's make him a pediatrician. No. This committee of NBC executives had what I can only imagine were countless meetings and discussions about this show, and in their infinite wisdom, they decided to make him a vagina doctor. Okay, fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Vagina doctor. A vagina doctor in a fancy medical building or hospital? No. That would be too easy. Let's make him a vagina doctor in his own fucking basement. I mean, that's really weird, right? I mean, what the fuck? You know who else works on women in their basement? Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. And again, I'm not trying to say, oh, you know, OBGYN, it's weird. But I mean, it's just interesting that in 1983, this big committee of people and censors and all this, and that's what they landed on. It just seems really strange to me. So anyway, let's discuss the bow ties on this show. So some of the stuff gets kind of nitpicky. The men of The Cosby Show do not wear traditional bow ties. Nope. They wear these strange-looking, like, Afrocentric ties. I looked them up, and apparently they're called crossover ties. Here's why I find it odd. They often wear these ties. They're often the only people wearing these types of ties. There's no way in hell anyone else in the room knows what the fuck they are, and they clearly stand out. So why is it never addressed? I've been to thousands of social gatherings. If anyone is wearing anything remotely unique, it is met with no less than 200 comments or questions, but not in Huxtable Land. No one dare ask Dr. William H. Cosby Jr., EDD, what the fuck he has wrapped around his throat. I just think it's weird how they choose to be different, but they don't address the difference. They don't address the uniqueness. All right, third up. Since we're discussing fashion, let's do that. Let's take a quick gander at Dr. Huxtable's pajamas. He wears a long gown to bed. No one in the history of pop culture has ever worn pajamas like this except for Dr. Huxtable and Ebenezer Scrooge, like whilst he's being whisked around London by those three fucking ghosts. I mean, how does a man with such unsexy pajamas fuck his wife enough to produce five children? I just don't understand. Very, very weird. This show features two almost identical misogynistic male characters. First, as mentioned, we meet Sandra's boyfriend and eventual husband, Elvin. Elvin has some pretty old-fashioned thoughts on gender roles. Women, like his own mother, shouldn't work outside the home. They should prepare the meals, take care of the kids, etc. He's always saying some dumb shit that pissed everyone off, but he eventually learns his lesson, and he evolves into being a beaten-down, submissive husband just like the rest of us. Honestly, I'm fine with this. It's a fun character and an avenue to explore equality between men and women. Odd, though, that there's almost an identical character in the form of Rudy's friend Kenny. Or Bud, as Rudy calls him. But Bud has the same thoughts on women and their place in the world. He says the same dumb things as Elvin and always pisses off the Huxtable women. Why do we need two of these? I mean, this is a smart, well-written show with tons of characters. Why do they go out of their way to have two sexist men? I have a theory. I think Bill Cosby is a sexist asshole and likes sexist jokes and therefore requested two sexist characters to tell the women on the show to shut up and bring him a cup of coffee. Just a theory, but I have to imagine he was really into this shit. The show is about an African-American family living in Brooklyn in the 1980s and early 1990s. The age range and life experience of these characters is vast. Cliff and Claire's parents are alive and retired. Cliff and Claire are professionals approaching middle age. The kids range from recent college grad to middle school. The grandchildren are toddlers. So many black years lived in America, and not one mention of racism, ever. I grew up in New York City. I'm going to tell you, the N-word comes up a lot, but not in Huxtable Land. There were many race crimes, specifically in Brooklyn in the 80s, not in Huxtable Land. Almost 100% of black people growing up in America have experienced some form of racial intolerance at least once in their life. Not in Huxtable Land. Why did Bill Cosby, with his stupid fucking PhD, never use this platform to discuss the black experience in America? Because I'm not black, but I'm pretty fucking certain though, this show did not depict any black person's actual experiences anywhere at any time ever. It's so unrelatable. I don't understand. It could have been such a huge platform. Next up. Now, again, this might be nitpicky, but I was always finding myself incensed when the Huxtables couldn't just experience simple shit in life like the rest of us. Okay, here's an example. In season 3, episode 22, Cliff and Claire are sick in bed with the flu, except they don't have the type of flu that you or I get. They had the Andalusian flu. They must have repeated the phrase Andalusian flu about 6 million times throughout the episode. I've never heard of the Andalusian flu prior to or after that episode. My kids and I seem to only attract flu A or flu B. I mean, so even the Huxtables' fucking illnesses aren't relatable. The Andalusian flu. Cliff, you have the Andalusian flu. What? Shut up. All right. This is also nitpicky. But why do Cliff and Claire, while exhausted in the middle of the day, try and take a nap on the couch? Now, let me remind you. At any given point, there are 6 to 8 people living in this house. The home is also often frequented by friends and neighbors. So why would anyone not looking to be disturbed try and nap on a couch that is both in the middle of the living room and only 11 feet from the front door? I mean, they have that nice big master bedroom upstairs that contains 50% of the family's bathrooms. Why not slip on those Scrooge jammies and hop in bed for a nap, Cliff? I don't understand. But it happened quite often. They would nap on the couch and get mad when they got woken up. I was like, then fucking go upstairs. All right, I mentioned this next phenomenon earlier, but I wanted to take a moment to explore it further. In addition to there being no racial inequality in Huxtable Land, there's also no premarital sex nor divorce. Cliff's parents are still happily married, as are Claire's and Elvin's for that matter. Cliff and Claire grow more in love each day, even after raising 5 children, and you can bet your sweet ass they were virgins when they were married. Sandra and Elvin reach each other's first, and I have no doubt they'll remain happily ever married for all eternity. Hell, the only member of the family to ever experience divorce is Denise's husband, Martin. He was previously married prior to Denise, but as if to repair this blemish on the family record, he does in one scene go out of his way to tell Cliff that Denise was a virgin when they married. Weird conversation, by the way, to have with your father-in-law, in my opinion. The biggest scandal his family experiences in the marriage arena is that Vanessa gets engaged without telling her parents. Ooh, and he's older. Oh, God. And he's a maintenance man. Oh, my God, not a professional. She eventually breaks off the engagement, though, and all is right again in Huxtable Land. No premarital sex, no divorce, ever. In keeping with the above theme, everyone, while remaining virginal, will also complete college. Everyone in the Huxtable orbit goes to college. Sandra and Elvin met in college and are on their way to prominent legal and medical careers, respectively. Theo went from being a D student in high school to being the king of academia. Vanessa went to college. I'm sure Rudy and Olivia and the grandchildren will all attend some prominent school as well. Even the black sheep of the family, Denise, finds her way back to college by the time the series ends. So well done, Huxtables. All college grads, no divorce, no premarital sex. So fucking unrelatable. Now, I used to wonder if Bill Cosby's show was so unrelatable because this is how he wishes the world truly was. No racism, no divorce, no premarital sex. Everyone attends a university and becomes a professional. It doesn't sound bad. Boring, maybe, but not bad. But later, when slapped in the face with all of his sexual antics and bullying and lies, it makes him look like a mean, old, narcissistic fuck. I'll leave you with this. Season 7, Episode 3. It was titled The Last Barbecue. Realizing that Martin never had a bachelor party prior to marrying Denise, Theo decides to step up and plan a fun shindig for the fellas. He upsets the Huxtable women when they find out he hired a stripper for the bachelor party. This is unsettling. A stripper in Huxtable Land just feels weird. But that's not the weird part of this episode. Not at all. The weird part's coming up. While all the couples are arguing over the virtues of strippers, now it's getting nasty and everyone's fighting, Cliff is in the background preparing a family backyard barbecue, the highlight of which will be his famous homemade barbecue sauce. We eventually learn that his homemade sauce is famous not just for being tasty, but also because it is an aphrodisiac. His barbecue sauce makes people horny. And we later see it. The couples, Sandra and Elvin, Denise and Martin, Cliff's parents, they have fought all afternoon about this stripper nonsense, but now they all get turned on. They're all lovey-dovey when they finally get a spoonful of Cliff's sauce. He makes a sauce that gets everyone sexually excited. This idea came from the mind of a man who has been accused of countless drug-facilitated sexual assaults. Bill Cosby was laughing at us because he's a creep. A sick fucking creep. And that's how I experienced The Cosby Show. And that's a wrap on Season 5, Episode 8 of Fanacheck. That's a wrap on Keeping House. Tune in next time for some different 80s stuff. Again, if you like the show, please hit me up. Like it, review it. You can find me on Facebook. I'm Real Fanacheck. I'm on X. I guess it's Twitter. It's X now. I call it Twitter. I'm on X as at Fanacheck Podcast. You can email me, fanacheckpodcast@gmail.com. I'm still sending out tons of stickers. I've got a YouTube channel. Look it up. Just look up Fanacheck on YouTube. I've interviewed quite a few celebrities there. And you know what I really want you to do? I want you to stay tuned for the next exciting, relatable episode of Fanacheck.